They have it here.
Grid space network requirement consistent with federal rules. 1303.0803 outlines the process for resolving overdrafts. Vehicle for customer and resolving the 1303.1504 outlines the process for establishing a branch. This makes clear the qualification requirements. 1303, this was the member business loan rule, which has been appealed or will be appealed. 1303.20 outlines the requirements for publications. As I mentioned, this was a definition change, and we also added some things to make clear that it did not expand participation of voting. 1303.23 relates to credit service organizations. This makes clear that a subsidiary of the credit union can itself own a subsidiary, consistent with current practices and federal rule. It also makes clear the process for structuring and monitoring those subsidiaries consistent with federal rule. 1303.26, 27, and 28 are defined as new section of rule. They're new to state rules. They're not new to credit unions. These are duplications of federal rule to put them in state rules so that it's clear they do apply. 26 relates to credit union interest, monitoring of interest rate risks. 27 relates to credit union monitoring of liquidity and contingency funding plans. And 28 relates to loan workouts and loan modifications. We were asked to discuss whether or not a regulatory analysis is required. It was not. We were asked to discuss the economic impact of this on small entities. The department did complete a small entity regulatory analysis and a small entity economic impact statement. Both documents indicate that the financial and regulatory impact of these proposed amendments are minimal in nature. As a result of these changes, there may actually be in some ways less impact because we have reduced limits as far as fixed assets requirements and made clear the requirements of rules, federal rules that apply to state chartered credit unions. We were asked to discuss this one. One was not deemed to be required because this should have no impact on state revenues or expenditures. A constitutional takings assessment was not required. And finally, these rules were not adopted as unsuccessful.
There is no problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome. First time here, I understand. So, I have a general question for you in specifics, and that is, for most of your testimony, essentially what you're trying to do is mirror what the federal government has done, rules and so on. I'm also curious, you mentioned that there was a letter, apparently a concern, that was submitted by the Credit Union Association. I need to quote this. What was the nature of that? Can you touch on like what they objected to and how you responded? And
Chairman Gilding, I'm representing Kaufman. Yes, the Credit Union Association of Dakotas objected to a couple of things. They were not real happy with the duplication of federal rules. Their concern was that over time the federal rules would change, state rules would not. We felt that that risk was limited in relation to the risk of surveys, seeing where credit unions didn't know the rule applied to them, and we were citing violations simply because it's impossible. So that was one of their concerns. We reviewed it, and the State Rating Board concluded that we just have to keep up with our rules, keep up with the changes. Another concern was the concern related to the merger process, the publication requirements. We made an attempt to make it more clear where during merger they would need to publish the name of this. They didn't like the wording that we had. The Bankers Association had a similar objection. So we did change our wording, which was ultimately determined to be a much more much more palatable for them.
Yeah.
Another concern they had was the fixed asset limit. They felt that we should not have a fixed asset limit whatsoever, which would be consistent with the wording of the federal rule, but inconsistent with the banks that we regulate. We felt that it was rather disingenuous to make the statement that there is no fixed asset limit, because when the federal government repealed their limit, they issued supervisory guidance, which essentially said the exam is in the field for the whole credit to the old benefit basis. And if they ceded that, they were, in my words, not theirs, basically to do a very thorough examination of the thought process. We thought that's a disingenuous approach to regulation. We made clear that this is the standard limit. We did add some flexibility for very high net worth institutions. And we also continue to have a waiver process. If they do have the need of business to go above that, they credit board to see that application and can make a determination before an examination that whether or not that expenditure makes sense. If it doesn't, we can address it outside of an examination process before it's too late.
So what troubles me a little bit about this, and I was not aware of all the detail, but it does kind of dovetail in my other questions. You sort of sound like an outpost to the federal government. I don't mean that unkindly or to criticism, but we see this sometimes in agencies of state government, and particularly those that are regulated federally. But before I get into that, let me ask you a question, because I don't know the answer to this. With respect to credit unions that are state chartered, I mean, I understand that banks, which you also regulate, oftentimes are very carefully examining federal rules and federal law because they're federally chartered or they're governed federally because of interstate commerce. Smaller particular credit union that operates completely within the confines of maybe a couple of counties of our state, I mean our entire state, why are they subject to all of that regulation?
Chairman
Gilbean,
representative of the credit unions are insured by the federal government, their deposits are insured. And it's that insurance regulation, in this case it's NCUA, it's the state agency, that is basically the same concept.
Sure.
So it's those insurance regulations that apply to credit unions. And NCUA is a little bit unique from FDIC. When you get FDIC insurance, you know what applies to you because FDIC rules are FDIC rules. And NCUA is unique in that they have both chartering authority and insurance. So it's two hats. So you can be federally chartered and all their rules will apply to you. Or you can be state chartered and part of their rules will apply to you. And the way they structure them is very hard to determine what the differences are. So yes, we do have a lot of parallels with FDIC. What we try to do, I'm sorry, with NCUA, what we try to do is we try to go in there and buck out pieces that do apply to the state charter. That apply whether or not we like it or not. It's just the federal rules you have. And we put them in the state code. Those that don't, we left out. And that's been a point of a lot of frustration. I'm hoping this will engage that frustration.
And I'm clear to you that you have which applying what you're doing is not clear to the institutions themselves.
Representative Delveen, Chairman Delveen, Representative Delveen,
by the way.
Was that
Delveen?
Delveen. I'm not doing well, that's my biggest mistake. I actually, it was a real struggle. We spent a lot of time sorting this out. At various points in my career, I spent my whole career reviewing NCUA rules. 15 years I've been trying to sort this out. I've been in a room with two attorneys and myself, reading line by line, trying to separate it out. It is impossible. It is very hard, and we voiced our concern over the years ad nauseum to the federal government on this one. We have not had any success. This is our best second option. And we have sorted them. We're very confident that the ones that we put in here are applicable. And because of that, I think this will add clarity.
So one more question regarding everything you said before I get to a couple specifics in the rules. You mentioned trying to discern if I understood you just said correctly, where the federal government had removed the rule or appeal rule, but someone had issued guidance that seemed to make safer rule. Your safer rule stands essentially in your relation you're doing, as I understood what you said, like, to avoid confusion, to avoid setting out a line and so on. The concern I have with that is if you talk with anyone that deals with the federal government, the agency of the federal government, most of the agencies are notorious for issuing guidance, so-called guidance. Oftentimes they're reticent to put it in writing for obvious reasons, and it's usually verbal as a result of that, and it can be different from one person to the next, one day to the next. So that is a little bit of a concern when you say, well, gee, there's this guidance that's been issued, so we're going to make that a rule. Does that bother you at all? Are you aware of that? Is that a concern?
Chairman Del Vino?
Yeah, well,
I apologize. Chairman Delvin, Representative Koppelman, it's less of a concern if we put it in rule, because then it's clear. The ambiguity that comes from examiner discretion, the wins of the post-current examination, I think that is outside of true good governance. Because then I can have three different examiners interpret the same thing three different ways, and how can anybody be expected to comply?
I understand. Of course, the bigger picture, you know, we don't look at this myopically, but look at the big picture is that, you know, the question of whether this is a good thing for us for credit means or not. I have no idea. I don't have an answer to that. I'm just curious because is an asset limit good or not? I mean, if they're saying, gee, we don't like this. And we're saying, well, there's a federal guidance that was issued, even though the federal rule went away. So I think you should still have to put it
in. Representative Devlin, Chairman Koppelman, I'm sorry. you make a point. That was a good question. There have been institutions that have overextended.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize, but I've got a couple of specifics to make. So the one thing that does concern me a bit, and I'm looking at the 1503-0202, page 4. I noticed that in item number 3 there, you've stricken a previously existing rule and said that we don't feel so much and you said you referenced the federal statute. That always bothers me a little bit because those things are subject to change, number one. Number two, we don't know what they are. We're always looking them up, and you know, I'm sure that's not a Herculean task. But at the same time, I'm getting tired of the last legislative session passed unanimously. And I have to reintroduce the bill this session because the way that the Legislative Council drafted the bill, I think that's what it's the methodology, but they reference the federal statute. Guess what? Under change law. So now we're back making it, you know, but had they not noticed that, had I not, you know, been aware of it and planned to fix it on this end, it basically was non-functional. And so you end up in a bad scenario. When you talked about, you know, situations that you might run into, I don't think that's good practice. I mean, it's obviously your prerogative, but thoughts about that?
Chair Devlin, Representative Koppelman, we're very well aware of your points, and we try real hard to avoid that wherever possible, and we try to find that balance. I don't know if we necessarily found the balance. With this specific item, you referenced the federal rule, the conclusion was it made more sense to do so. I believe that's mostly in definitions, and because of that, we did feel comfortable doing that, but it is a calculated.
And of course, it's your rule spending and your cost if you have to come back. Rewrite the rules and catch up. You know, that. But the other one I had a question on was on our page 13 and 14, and it's 1303, 14, 1303 in the chapters. And that has to do with, you referenced this earlier, I think, the question of what publication has to be made. We've dealt with that, these issues a lot in the legislature, and it appears, as I read this, the original rule said county or counties affected. By the expansion, it sounds to me like you're saying the county in which the expansion is located. So, and I'm looking at 15 there, and I guess in the case of 14, it is the the county which is proposed to be implemented by the membership. Just so I understand, any county affected then will require publication.
Chair Dillon, President Hoffman, yes, the intention was to define when counties were affected. It was unclear before how to define that. We think that we would touch anybody who is affiliated with that membership.
So in other words, if a credit union was operating in three counties and they expanded to five, two that were expanded into and two affected, we would have to be publishing the asset.
Chairman Dillon, Representative, yes, as well as the home office, and so the three counties. Mr. Chairman, for after 500 hours of work, working with credit unions and certain bankers and credit unions in your opposition, everybody's kind of happy about where you landed as far as these rules. Chairman Dillon, Senator Klein.
Klein.
I think we reached a good spot. We went on the way to the Trading Association as we were redrafting to the second time. I think we did plenty of opportunities. And the Bankers Association as well, we did this in the second time. We think we addressed it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question of the legislative council. We've come upon this before, Representative Hoffman's concern about playing a federal statute and central code over in law, and he's mentioned that he's got a redraft legislation now. I would like to ask Lynette if there's any druthers that the legislative council has, or is there any precedent that says, yeah, you should or shouldn't put something in separate federal law and century code or in administrative rules?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Heckerman, it's kind of on a case-by-case basis, but typically, you know, we put this in our bill drafting manual that, and as like Representative Koppelman said, what we put in there is what's in effect at the time the bill goes into effect. Sometimes it's difficult to avoid those references. The one exception to that is the Internal Revenue Code that we don't have to repass those kind of bills. That includes as amended. I guess it just kind of depends on the subject matter. I'm not familiar with Representative Koppelman's bill or what happened with that one, but there are things that are just tied to federal law that, you know, that are unavoidable. When that, you know, the alternative would be put writing in the entire federal law, which could be, you know, make your bill go from 2 pages to 200 pages. So it's kind of a, we handle it as they come up, is the best answer I can give. Correct, Mr. Chairman, Senator. It's whatever was in effect at the time. So it's a delegation issue. I mean, it's an unlawful delegation of legislative authority to enact something that hasn't gone into effect yet. It's new. So you would be giving your authority to the federal government to change state law. Is the reason that we you know. Yeah, right. And we can't say as amended because then it's a delegation issue.
Good morning, Chairman, President,
think they came to some, we'd asked them to.
I'll give a few seconds.
I'm not sure if he's going to address that first or if he's going to take us.
And the reason we did that is one is for the existing health department, and the other one is for the future Department of Environmental Quality, so we don't have to go through the process of the document. So we're proposing both under the existing section and under the.
These are the same.
So we.
About three. So good morning. I'm one of the members of the Administrative Rules Committee. Again, like I said, my name is Dave Clark, Section Chief from the Environmental Health Section. On September 12, 2018, the Administrative Rules Committee carried over NDAC 33-16-03.1, subsection 13, subsection 1, and NDAC 33.1-16-03.1, subsection 13, subsection 1, and requested the North Dakota Department of Health to revisit this line item. As you recollect, the line item dealt with the definition of significant revisions. And the committee wanted more clarity on what significant meant. The department has been in contact with the North Dakota Stockman's Association and the North Dakota Livestock Alliance. Today we present an updated version. The department feels will address the concerns brought up during the public comment period and the September 12th committee meeting. If you refer to the, just have to refer to the one of the sections of the pages that are both the same except for the citation of above. It states a public notice requesting comment on applications for both individual permits and general state animal feeding operation permits shall be issued if the department determines a significant degree of public interest exists regarding a newer or expanding facilities, or, and this is where the committee asked for some additional clarifications, a plan that we required a public notice under subsection A has any of the following changes to the approved nutrient management plan. One, a greater than 10% reduction in acres available for land application. Two, the addition of surface or subsurface drainage. Three, a change in the method of manure application. We're hopeful that as an operator that you will see this and you know clearly at what point additional comment would be needed on the nutrient management plan. And that's clear that we can make it, you know, it's pretty straightforward. We would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to address this concern. And also, again, working with the various commodity groups to make sure that this clarity is something that makes sense to them and they can live with. This concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. Well, they're both will be the same, and that's just an oversight. So they don't apply. The 33-16 is existing on the existing department. 33.1 will be for the new one.
Who second? Okay, good job.
Goodbye. Hold on, there's no one who's regulating any of that new checking. Any other questions?
To 33. Representative Devlin?
Yes.
O'Shea? Koppelman?
Yes.
Lauzer? Heil? Schatz? Schneider? Tolman? Weiss? Senators Pullman? Anderson? Heckelman? Klein? Cruen? Meyer? And Rust? Mr. Chairman, the motion carries.
Thank you.
And then we have them back again then.
Dave, you got the next one.
Yeah, I do.
Remember you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and members of the community, my name is Tom Watson, and with the Division of Air Quality of the Health Department, I'm here to address changes to Article 3341-15, pollution control, which is common in cases 41 and 92. The air pollution control rules are related to Senate Bill 2327 from the last legislative session. Revisions update the rules to aid the transition to the Department of Environmental Quality. The changes to the rules are related to rules adopted by EPA under the Federal Clean Air Act. The rule changes were made to update state rules, match federal rules, and be consistent with federal requirements. Primary reason for adopting these revisions was to maintain privacy for the major air pollution control programs in North Dakota. Department could choose not to adopt the federal rules, but to lose the authority to regulate certain portions of the Clean Air Act, and the state could face sanctions. The process of adopting amendments to the air pollution control rules was in accordance with NDHC 2832 and 40 CFR 51.102. This included a comment period of more than 30 days, a public hearing, and approval of the revisions by the chief of the environmental section. Public hearing regarding the amendments was held on October 10th. The revisions were submitted to the Legislative Council on October 22nd, and the Attorney General's opinion is dated October 31st. During the public hearing, no oral comments were received. Written comments were received from three individuals. Two of those comments were not related to the proposed revision. One comment provided a revision of another section of the rule that was not being revised, and the other one air pockets monitoring in the Bakken region of North Dakota. The department will consider these requests for future action. The other comment erroneously thought that the revisions would weaken the ambient quality standards for ozone. The amendments actually make the ozone standard more stringent. The amendments do not reduce any requirements that would adversely affect air quality. The approximate cost of getting public notice, holding a hearing, developing and adopting the rules is $400. Revisions updated state rules to be consistent with federal requirements. This included changes to the ambient air quality standard of ozone, prevention of significant contamination rules, construction permitting rules, and the Title V permit operator rules. The regulatory analysis was prepared. There were no requests for that regulatory analysis. The copy of the cast was kept by testimony. board expenditures by the department. Statements of adjustment was prepared, copy is also attached to my testimony. The filing of the rule provisions were not adopted as an emergency rule. At this time, we'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Chair and several other members of the committee. My name is Julie Ellison with the North Dakota Bachman's Association. I just wanted to tack on and say thank you to the committee for setting aside those roles and thank the health department for the DEQ, whatever their help these days, for sending three different meetings with us to revive them. We think what was done today creates more business certainty for the regulated community as well as other interested stakeholders. You might remember that we also raised a couple of questions about a couple of other references to significant public interest. Those weren't part of what was being changed, and so we have requested that in future rulemaking that it also be considered for revision and more prescriptive and descriptive language for the regulated community. Thank you again. We appreciate your help in this effort.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I believe you're right. You're coming in first.
Okay, gotcha. I guess I'm married to this. Okay. Nope, appreciate that. He didn't notice.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Holm. I'm an attorney with the Department of Human Services. We have two different rules making sets today. We're going to go through the first one, which is on page 95 through 99, and also it starts again on 115 and 144. The proposed amendments to North Dakota Administrative Code Chapter 75.0103 and 75.0801 are not related to any statutory changes by the legislative assembly. These rules are necessary in part to comply with the federal law, Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and its final regulations. We need our normal mailings, publication, postings, closing hearing, taking oral comments and written comments. In addition, then, there was no comments that were received at the public hearing, but we did receive two written comments. The summary of comments is attached to the report. the cost of giving notice was $2,400, and one a little over $2,400. The changes start again on page 96, 97, and that's two sections 7501, 03, 02. We're repealing a lot of the language that was in our appeal code and for regarding the VR, but we're placed it into the VR code. So it's all being moved over and updated based on the federal regulation in the VR section. So we'll go through that in a minute. But that's all basically those changes in 750103. I'll start, which is basically the meat of the changes, which is on page 120. And that's going to be 7508-0101. We amended a lot of the definitions. We added some definitions. In 7508-0102, we amended to create consistency in terms throughout the chapter. We did this throughout all the sections. We replaced vocational rehabilitation with divisions and to clarify the verification process if an individual is not a U.S. citizen. Next, we made a lot of changes, like I said, for consistency in different sections. That's listed in my testimony, I won't go through each one. 7508-0107 is repealed, but that's the new way it was added to the appeal section, which is 7508-0107. 7508-0109, we amended the clarified language and to create consistency in terms throughout the chapter, which is the representative of the authorized representative. 7508-0111 and 7508-0115, we also amended the clarified language, create consistency in terms. Again, representative, authorized representative, replace vocational rehabilitation with the division. 7508-0114, we repealed, and that's again dealing with the appeal section, and that was moved to 7508-0137 as well. 7508-0116 is amended to create consistency in terms again, and to remove the extended evaluation if necessary exception to the time period to determine eligibility. 7508-0117, again, consistency terms changes. 7508-0118, also consistency changes. And also to add advanced info of vocational rehabilitation eligibility and documentation requirements. 7508-0120, consistency changes, but also to remove language that provided for extended evaluation services where an individual is not able to obtain trial work experiences. 7508-0121, again, consistency changes and the updated citation. 7508-0123, consistency changes, but also we made changes to reflect changes that were made in the appeal section related to mediation and the client assistance program, and to add additional categories of individuals in a priority list who is entitled to receive services under an individualized plan for employment. 7508-0124, consistency changes, but also change the time period for when an individual plan for eligibility individuals must be developed. We updated the citation, and we changed to extend the maximum period of time limited services may be provided from 18 to 24 months. 7508-0125, consistency changes again. 7508-0126, consistency changes. Also updated language regarding the NESET, fee scale and financial participation, to clarify that a vocational rehabilitation administrator may adjust or waive client financial participation to ensure that the level of the individual's participation and the cost of service is not so high to effectively deny services. 7508-0128, amended to create consistency in terms as well. 7508-0129, same consistency terms changes, but also to clarify language regarding post-employment services for individuals with disabilities and to extend the maximum period of time limited services may be provided from 18 to 24 months. 7508-0130, consistency changes, but also to clarify that an individual may choose to participate and the cost of attending post-secondary training reviews of college work studies to the policy. 75080132, and 33. This is changes, but also to clarify the notification requirements, clarify when you are imposing the individual's case, and change the individual with whom the appeal may be filed from the field supervisor of the department to the chief of field services of the division, which is called the Freedom of Education. 75080134, this is the changes, but also the change that the individual who an appeal may be filed again. To remove language regarding the determination of rehabilitation of an individual in support of employment when the individual is stabilized for a minimum of 60 days. To extend the period so that the individual in support of employment may obtain employment after transition to expect services to be determined rehabilitated for 60 to 90 days. To remove a requirement that an individual earning less than minimum wage is subject to an annual review of foreclosure. And to remove language regarding closing an individual's case for temporary transitional employment placements. 75080135, we remove language regarding the procedures to be used when an individual is extended employment as our case closed, and to add language regarding or requiring the division to review documents and assess employment outcomes for certain individuals. 75080136, create a detailed pre-employment transition services the division must provide or make available. 75080137, that's again, we have a large appeal section describing the rights of the client to receive notices, mediation rights and process, appeal rights and process, reasonable accommodation, informal legal rights and process, and the claimant's right to continue to receive services pending resolution of the claimant's claim or appeal. There was no written request for regulatory analysis filed by the governor or any other agency. The rule amendments are not expected to have an impact on the regulated community in excess of 6,000. The regulatory analysis, the economic impact statement, and the constitutional takings assessment were prepared and part of the council report. Again, fiscal impact is nominal. Rules are not adopted as a Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. So on
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coop, that'll be the next rulemaking step, so I'm going to be able to answer your question at that time. Yes, one more. Sorry.
Thank you. Any further questions about the person?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the next set of rules is starting at page 100 to 114. That's the child support guidelines. 7502041. They're not related to any statutory changes that were made during the 2017 legislative assembly, not related to any federal statute or regulation either. They are necessary in part of the federal regulations and state law that require child support guidance to be reviewed every 4 years. Again, the department did a formal rulemaking process, direct mail, electronic mailing, publication, posting, public hearing, receiving them. Recording the commentary for the hearing. No comments were received at the public hearing. We did receive one written comment. The summary of comments is attached to the report. The cost was $2,313.42. The rules again start on page 101. Section 7502.04.101 is amended to revise the calculation for the deduction for the hypothetical federal income tax obligation, removing the reference to a personal and dependent exceptions child tax credit, to revise the calculation for the hypothetical state income tax obligation to 11% of the hypothetical federal income tax obligation, and increase the deduction for lodging expenses for employment-related travel within the definition of net income. 7502.04.102 is amended to remove language in the general instructions specifying that determination of child support obligation is appropriate whenever the child and both parents do not reside together, and to clarify language regarding parental time overnights. 7502.04.101 is amended to clarify that income of obligor spouse may not be used or treated as income of the to the obligation obligor for child support purposes. Just to change the function. 7502.04.101 is amended to revise the threshold or number of parenting time or nights at which the extended parenting time adjustment becomes applicable to clarify language regarding parenting time over nights. 7502.04.109 is amended to create a rebuttal criteria to allow the equalizing of parent respective obligations in certain situations. When the parents have equal residential responsibility for the children. 7502.04.110 is a mandatory revise the schedule of amounts to increase self-support reserve for low-income obligors, as well as to reduce the amounts due to obligors with net income slightly above self-support reserve. There was no written request for analysis by the governor and the other agency. The impact of proposed rules cannot be precisely determined. It may have an impact on regulatory community in excess of 50,000. The regulatory analysis and the small entity regulatory analysis, small entity economic impact statement, and the constitutional takings were prepared and are attached to the report. The rules were not adopted as emergency rules. That concludes my testimony.
Senator Kirby,
you have
a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at 7502.04.1 and comments regarding the guideline model, the guideline would take into consideration the comments that that individual made required a loss of income. Having been in these positions many, many times, running two childcare facilities, running roughly 175 kids every day, I ran into quite a crazy situation. Part of what the response is very, very clear, very good. I can understand what they are, and they can enforce in that respect, and they should continue to be enforced in that respect. But one of the things that continuously comes up is the expenses that each individual has in the divorce case. And sometimes should be an analysis of the expenses as well as the income of those individuals to make sure that those dollars that are being spent on child support are actually going to the child, not supporting someone else's living expenses. And that's one of the things that continuously comes up in this conversation all the time. I've been in the middle of several of them, and that's part of the situation. I think we should take a look at that. The other thing is that Mr. Fleming and I have had a lot of discussions about advance notice of when there's multiple children in the family, and as they get to that 18 age, that technically they think when the divorce is written by their attorney, that automatically gets reduced at that point in time. But it doesn't specifically say the dollar amount in there. It doesn't get reduced, and that individual, say there's three kids, and one of them graduates from high school, they reach the age of 18, and he doesn't take it back to court at that point in time, or her, actually, in both cases. This, I say neutral gender is very important, because that's happened in both ways, is that it's not reduced until they go back to court. And somehow or other, either we should, as a department, indicate those rules that they should have to do that, because they don't understand it, because they just assume that it's going to be reduced. And the judges, I've talked to three different judges, one has passed away and two retired already, so maybe we have to take a look at it again and make sure that they're aware that they have to go back and redo that if it is not stated in the original divorce decree. I got to the point where when parents applied for my child care facilities, asked for their marital status. And at that point in time, I thought, and if it was a divorce case, I asked for their marital divorce status and their divorce decree, because I'd be in the middle of who's paying what at different times and who's responsible for different things. And so we did that on our own to do that, and I think we should take a strong look at that as well. And especially with cases where one individual is paying child support and they're actually supporting another individual in their home or vice versa. And we don't know for sure if those children are actually getting the care that should be afforded them with the child support that comes through, along with the notification when the child support should change. And that's a little bit of part of this, a little bit off of this, but I think we should take a good look at that point in time. The other thing that's happened over a period of time, and I've been out of this business for about 10 years already, but even 10 years ago, the income levels have equalized and parent responsibilities have shifted, and this general neutral at times. And so we should take a look at more, like I say, expenses of what's happening to make sure that all the expenses, both income and the expenses that those people have, should be shared equally according to what that's one of the things I picked up on here from experience. Take a look at it. I think we should be very cognizant of those issues that are coming.
Questions from the committee? No? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone here from the regulation anyone to do? Thank you. Thank you. We'll move on to the Board of University of School Lounge.
Oh, thank you. Okay, sorry.
Chairman Devlin, members of the Administrative Rules Committee. I have the respect of the Commissioner and the University of Florham. On behalf of the North Dakota Department of Trust Lands, I'm here to request adoption of the Administrative Rules for the North Dakota Unclaimed Property and Energy Infrastructure Impact.
The rules represent the Administrative Rules Committee are a result of the House Bill 1300, in which the 65th Legislative Assembly directed the board no longer be exempt from the North Dakota Century Code Chapter 28-32. The department considered existing statutes, rules, together with policies and procedures, and incorporated those into administrative rules to comply with the Act. The drafted rules for general administration, unclaimed property, and energy infrastructure and impact grants outline agency standards used to implement, interpret, or set policy for the board and the department. Neither the rules for unclaimed property nor energy infrastructure and impact grants are subject to federal statute or regulations. Rules concerning unclaimed property and energy infrastructure and impact grants were posted to the department's website and the Secretary of State's website. Publications of notice of intent have been completed in all 53 county seat newspapers, and copies of these rules have been sent to sponsoring legislators. A public hearing on those rules was conducted on April 18, 2018, with no one from the public attending the hearing, thus the hearing officer opened and closed the hearing. Another public hearing on those rules was conducted on October 19, 2019, and no one from the public attended the hearing, thus the hearing officer opened and closed the hearing. A recording of the hearings has been posted to the department's website. During the public comment period, the Western Dakota Energy Association submitted a memorandum dated April 3, 2018, commenting on the proposed rules for the energy infrastructure and impact grants. Three issues were addressed, and considerations and comments are in my testimony. The first consideration was a request that it specifically identified, the WDA be identified for notification of this section when the grant opportunities are announced. The second one is the WDEA requested that the executive committee and members be given strong consideration for appointment to the advisory committee. And the third one was that the WDEA proposes that the length of the grant period be 2 years, not 3 years, and the applicant may apply for and be granted a single 2-year extension of the initial grant period. The approximate cost of giving public notice and holding the two necessary hearings, not including the staff time, is $2,000. A regulatory analysis is not required, neither is an economic impact statement. The implementation of these rules will not have any fiscal effect on the state revenues or expenditures. A constitutional takings assessment was not required, and these rules are not being adopted as emergency rules. Are there any questions I can answer?
Questions from the committee. Senator Heckman.
Excuse me, I just turned it off. Ms. Smith, on page 147 in our book, it's 85-010102. It says an exception. The board may grant an exception to this title when such exception is in the best interest of the trust. Can you explain what that means?
Just look at it really quick.
85-010102. It gives me a little pause when it says somebody may grant an exception. Exception to what?
The board tends to like to be able to make exceptions when it directly impacts the trust. I guess it would be relevant. The Energy Infrastructure and Impact Grant Department does not impact the trust at all. So those are appropriate funds from the legislators in this next session. We'll all determine if you continue to fund that program or not. So this would be relevant just to our unclaimed property department. So from time to time we get things that come through because the board's entire purpose really is to protect the trusts and the trusts that we oversee. So we have 13 trusts that we currently oversee. If something were to occur or to happen, that would be an emergency circumstance. The board would still have the authority to take that into consideration.
Okay, still gives me a little pause.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question then. So to Bonnet, does that mean that whatever rules are adopted here really don't have much effect if they can go over and above that? What does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Heckman, the wording in this is may grant an exception to this title. I'm wondering if that should be at a lower level if you're just referring to unclaimed property, if it should just be the article or the chapter rather than the title.
Because the title would be everything.
Title would be everything.
Yeah. And Chairman Devlin and Senator Heckman, this may be an oversight on our department's part when we had all of the rules kind of sitting here with you, and we're bringing just the energy infrastructure impact on unclaimed property forward to you today.
So do you have a suggestion, Vinette?
Well, if the intent is just to allow this exception to be granted for unclaimed property, it probably should refer to that specific section or chapter for unclaimed property.
Then, Mr. Chairman, how do we make that adjustment then?
If the department's in agreement, we can, we can offer an amendment, but I would just as soon have Vinette get the wording they would want for legislative council, so let's give her a minute here.
Thanks.
Article 8503.
So committee and Jody, to make it work the way we believe it should, we would change this title, take out that language, and change it to Article 85-03, which is unclaimed property.
I'm fine with that, Chairman Devlin.
Yeah. So if you're in agreement with that, and the committee's in agreement with that, we will offer a motion to amend this. Senator Heckman?
Yes, I would so move that we do that.
Second.
We have to have an emotion on it, yeah.
Second by Representative Conklin. Further discussion?
Roll call vote to change.
We need a roll call vote to change it. Thank you, Senator Heckman.
Representative Devlin?
Yes.
O'Shea?
Yes.
Koppelman?
Yes.
Lauser?
Yes.
Pyle?
Yes.
Schatz?
Yes.
Schneider?
Yes.
Tolman?
Yes.
Weiss?
Yes.
Senators Pullman?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Heckelman?
Yes.
Klein? Stein? Bruin?
Yes.
Meyer?
Aye.
And Rust?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the motion carries.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone here from the regulated community on these rules at all? Seeing none. Committee, anything for discussion and directives? Vinette?
Anything else?
We will, like I said, we will try to find a March meeting time that more or less works for everybody during the session, but there's no way around it. We have to meet. That's what the statute requires, and we need to meet. So I thank you all for being here this morning. I know it hopefully didn't mess up too many schedules and training opportunities. Thank you.